started with today's session. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Accessibility Online webinar series. My name is Claudia Diaz, and I'm Associate Director here at the Great Lakes ADA Center. This webinar series is a collaborative project between the ADA National Network and the U.S. Access Board. This session is brought to you via the Illuminate platform. I also want to bring your attention that you can receive the audio for this session on the telephone. If you wish to listen via the telephone, you can call the number on the screen. In the first slide, 712-432-3100, and your passcode is 930098. I just want to bring your attention to some of the webinar features available in the platform. As I've mentioned already, we have closed captioning, and the live captioning can be accessed by clicking on the CC icon found at the top, or you can do the keyboard command control F8. This will bring a pop-up screen that you can adjust to your preference. Also, if you prefer to just see the whiteboard slides and not the chat area, or adjust your slides in the view menu at the top, you can select layout preference, and there's a couple of options there that you can choose and play with to change your view. This webinar platform allows us to receive questions in the chat area. You can type your questions in the chat area throughout the session. They will be private, only viewable to the moderators, and those questions will only be addressed during the designated question and answer time. The last thing I would like to mention is the emotion icons and hand-raising features. Those can be distracting, and we ask that you refrain from using those during the session. At this time, I want to transfer it over to Peggy Greenwell from the Access Board, who will be your moderator for this session. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudia, and welcome everyone to our session on accessible communication elements and features. Today, we plan on focusing largely on Chapter 7 of the 2010 standard and the Architectural Barriers Act standard. And in addition to that, we're also going to be discussing some of the basics involved with Section 508, since we're also dealing with communication access, and many have requested that we sort of try to tie the two together. We have two presenters today for the session. The first presenter will be Rex Pace. Rex has joined the Access Board just a little over a year ago as a senior accessibility specialist, and he serves as our technical assistance coordinator. Now, he's not new to the field of accessibility and has over 23 years of experience in accessible design. More recently, he served as an accessibility architect with the Department of Justice Disability Rights Section, where he was providing technical and architectural assistance on the standards. And prior to that, he was working in North Carolina and the lead designer for the Center of Universal Design at the North Carolina State University. We're also going to be hearing today from David Backus. He is also an accessibility specialist at the board and has been here for a little over 11 years. He's responsible for providing technical assistance on both Section 508 as well as the Section 255 requirements. David came to the board from the Hearing Loss Association of America, where he served as director of the National Center on Assistive Technology. Prior to that, he was an assistant director of the Teleconsumer Hotline, where he managed their disability access program specializing in telecommunications consumer information. So before I turn it over to Rex, Claudia mentioned the questions. We will have time at the end of the presentation to respond to question, as well as some of the questions that were submitted in advance. Those questions are going to be addressed during the presentation to the extent possible. So while you can submit questions during the presentation, just know that we will not be able to respond to them until after the presentation is completed. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Rex.
Okay, thank you, Peggy. And hello, everyone. Let's go to slide 4. Oops, there we go. So today's session will be basically divided into two categories. One, which you'll be hearing from me, which is requirements and the standards, and then we'll have David will take a part later on and talk to us about Information and Communications Technology Access, or ICT, as you might have heard the abbreviation. Let's go to slide 5. So the primary focus of my presentation today is Chapter 7 of the standards, but I also address some other issues in the standard that we'll need to keep in mind. Please go to page 6, slide 6. And just to reiterate this, a lot of you probably already know this, but we now have new standards for both the ADA and ABA, and I say ABA, that's the Architectural Barriers Act, and these standards are based on guidelines developed by the Access Board, which were published in 2004. Next slide, please. That's slide 7. And we now have the 2010 ADA standards for accessible design, which are now the only standard as we've passed that magic March date. And this also is based on the Access Board's guidelines with a number of features that the Department, a number of requirements that the Department of Justice have added in. I'm not going to go back through those today. We've heard about those in earlier presentations, and you can refer to those webinars. But I will talk a little bit more about some issues related to the standards. If you can go to slide 8. So I'll be talking a lot about the design requirements, but it's important to know that communications access is an important part of the regulatory aspects of the Americans with Disabilities Act. A lot of entities will have obligations for communications that are also very important, and these may need to be considered in regard to policy procedures or program issues outside of the architectural issues of the standards, which we may be more familiar with. Some examples of the kind of issues that might need to be considered include sign language interpreters or accessible alternate formats. For example, in these two images on the left here, we have a woman and her baby talking to her doctor in the doctor's office, and we see somebody signing, interpreting that conversation. Now, something like this may be an issue that may be addressed under the regulations. And on the right image, we see a real estate contract negotiation, and we see that a husband and wife, and the wife is reading a large print document. So these issues can come up under the regulatory aspects of the ADA. It's important to be aware of that. And these, at times, can affect the use of equipment and devices. I'm not going to go into detail about that here today. I would make you aware of that. I'll make you aware of some important terms. Auxiliary aids and services is a term you'll see in there. Effective communication is a term you'll see. These are important words. And in particular, I would refer you to the two sections listed here, which are important regulatory sections that deal with communications, and you might want to investigate that. Again, I would refer to the Department of Justice and their website at www.ada.gov, which has some interesting materials on effects of communication and whatnot. Slide 9. But we also, many of us will want to be concerned with the Architectural Barriers Act, and this is the act that covers federal facilities. Facilities that are constructed, altered, or leased on behalf of the United States, and it can also affect facilities receiving certain types of federal financial assistance. And while I'll be talking predominantly from an ADA point of view, don't forget that Chapter 7 will also be important in these projects, and the requirements are basically the same. Slide 10. So bear in mind, if you're doing work with like the Department of Defense, the Postal Service, or the General Service Administration, which usually covers construction for most of the other departments of the federal government, you'll want to pay attention to these requirements in respect to those projects. So, and just as a note, the Department of Housing and Urban Development still uses the UFAS standard and is in the process of updating to the adopting the new guidelines. Let's go to slide 11. So I would refer you to our website for guidance on the various standards and how they relate. There's a page for ADA and a page for ABA. You can find a lot of useful information there. Let's go to slide 12. And while I'll be focusing on the requirements, it's important to put them into the context of both new construction and alterations. They will come up. And so, for instance, if we have a telephone or we're replacing a telephone, meeting the requirements could be an issue. We'll want to pay attention to that. Also, the implication when we do path projects where a path of travel might be an issue, where we're altering a primary function area and we're considering the features along that path of travel, something like a telephone could come up in that situation. Now, the priorities are generally speaking with parking and entrances and accessible routes, but sometimes these communication features can come up, so they would need to be considered. They may not be as high priorities as some other issues, but do consider them. Slide 13. So, excuse me. So, starting with Chapter 7, one of the good things about the new standard, well, like so many other topics, it's all been collected in a single area of the standard. So all the communication features that used to be kind of dispersed throughout the standards are now, the technical parts are now here in this one chapter, so it's all in one place. And there's a lot more detail on some of these elements. We'll go through each of these topic areas in order, and we'll go ahead and start with fire alarms on on slide 14. All right. So fire alarms are accessible fire alarms or fire alarms are consistent with the requirements are required when they're provided in public and common use areas. For employee work areas, the visual alarms are not really required initially, but we need to install a system that can accept the wiring for a visual alarm at a later date. And additionally, the standards specifically address transient lodging guest rooms and residential dwelling units. There are two other instances where they're addressed. Now, there's an important alterations exception that's in the standard that was not before. Compliance is only required when the system is upgraded, replaced, or a new one installed. So if we have an instance where we're just renovating a room, sometimes it's not really practical to come in and add a visual alarm. One of the things about these older alarm systems, which maybe only use horns, is visual alarms can require a significant more amount of power to the system to have more power than some of these older alarms. So it's not always practical just to go in and add a single visual alarm to a system. Therefore, this exception is an acknowledgement that it can be difficult to do at times. Let's go to slide 15. Another interesting thing about the alarm requirements is that it's an instance where we use what's called a reference standard. We reference out the technical requirements to the NFPA 72 National Fire Alarm Code, years 1990 or 2002. And for those who may want to know, NFPA stands for the National Fire Protection Association. So the requirements are actually in that code, and we reference to it. There are a few issues that are addressed in the scoping provisions. The standards do address the maximum sound level and an exception for systems in medical care facilities. That exception for medical care facilities accounts for the way patients are managed in emergency situations. A lot of times patients are kind of escorted, so to speak, in a way that normally would not happen. You can see we're having some of these alarms, like in a cardiac care area, would be problematic. Slide 16. So NFPA 72 covers the flash rate and pulse duration of the alarm. This is how often the visual signal flashes and how long it's on for. And this is an important issue for people with epilepsy because there can be issues in regard to the frequency of flashes. So that's now been accounted for. Also, another big change is that fire alarm appliances, the signaling devices, can be located on the ceiling. Under the previous standard, they had to be on the wall. And also the minimum intensity of the visual alarm is addressed. This is basically a candela, or basically how bright the alarm is. And this can be affected by the design or purpose of the space that the visual alarm is located in. And generally speaking, now you now have larger coverage. The alarms cover more area than before through fewer appliances, because the maximum distance the alarm has to project in the room is now more relative to where it's located at and the brightness. It's candela. The previous 50-foot requirement is now a more relative one, and it's not the same. So as such, many spaces can be covered by more than one alarm appliance. Of course, certain spaces like corridors will still require multiple appliances. And also another important issue is the synchronization of multiple visual alarms in a space. If the alarms are going off at different times, then that's effectively increasing the flash rate and pulse duration. We want to maintain that at the appropriate level. Let's go to slide 17. So that was some basic overview of the alarms. Let's talk some about signs. And signs are basically, most signs fall into one of two categories. These are designations for permanent room spaces and are permanent features of the building, such as exit doors, exit stairs, and so forth. And then signs that are informational, that give us direction or instruction or tell us something about the space, but it's really not a permanent feature. So generally speaking, most signs fall in one of two categories. Now, the designations for permanent rooms have to have both tactile and visual requirements, because they're addressing both issues. People who read the letter, so to speak, by touching it, or the braille companion with it, or they can read, but some features such as contrast, clear typeface, and all are beneficial. Now, I want to add a correction. The information in the parentheses is incorrect. That is supposed to be sections 703.2 through 703.4, addressing race, character, braille, height, and location. These, as opposed to, so that's not visual characters. That's a mistake in there. The directional informational signs are required to meet the visual provisions only. And they are in section 703.5. Now, the two categories of signs do share contrast and finish requirements. Some of the visual provisions do differ to account for the fact that the designation signs are serving two functions, the tactile and visual. Therefore, it changes the visual requirements some, but in concept, they're very similar to the directional and informational signs. Let's go to slide 18. So there are some signs now that are not covered. They're clearly exempted. They would be temporary signs, building menus, directories and addresses, company names and logos, certain signs in detention and correctional areas that are not used by the public. These are exempted. Let's go to slide 19. And here's a variety of examples showing the distinguishing between how the signs might break out. For instance, if something says room 23 or restroom or mechanical rooms, these are permanent spaces and have to meet both tactile and visual requirements. In a similar fashion, things that say exit or designate the floor or space, excuse me, these are permanent signs, as opposed to those signs that only are informational or directional, such as exit this way, you know, something that says what an area is, like accounting department, or instructs people to do something that a visitor must sign in. Those are visual requirements only. And, of course, some examples of exempt would be like the building directory or because this information changes over time, it's not required to meet the visual or tactile requirements. Something like Mr. C. Smith Accountant, that's really a temporary aspect. It would not be covered. Let's go to slide 20. Now, some other signs are specifically addressed in the standards. There's some issues around means of egress to address. In particular, I would like to note that the exit discharge is often not have a tactile feature, and that's important to realize that when you come out of these exit stairs, you're not at the end of the egress route, so you need to carry this all the way through. The standards also address some issues with areas of refuge and directional signs in terms of instructions and so forth. It also addresses parking, but interestingly, the parking signage requirements are actually a reference to the parking section. That's where you actually get the specifics. So I won't go into detail about that today. It's more of a site feature. But there is an important exception in here where there's four or less parking spaces, then you don't have to have the sign. The space still needs to be marked, so you have to have an accessible space, but you don't have to have the sign. And it also has some exceptions where for assigned parking in residential areas when it's obvious people know who are going to be using the sign. And then also included here about signs and amusement rides. It's kind of interesting because this is an instance where, you know, most of the time the sign requirements are you follow them if you're providing something. We usually do provide signs, but it's an if you provide. The amusement ride is interesting because these are required signs. And basically, these are there to inform patrons what they can expect about what kind of access is offered or what kind of where the accessible loading and unloading zones on a ride is. So basically, you don't have to wait in line before you find out you can't or don't want to do something. Slide 21, please. There's also some of the requirements in the previous standards addressing identification of accessible features when not all are accessible are there. They're basically as they were before, identified with the International Symbol of Accessibility and direction toward them. They're, like I said, pretty much as they were before. Checkout aisles are addressed, and there is a requirement that the identification be with the aisle information. So if you have aisle 5, the symbol is with the number 5 and so forth. If we can go to slide 22. And identification of TTYs in assistive listening systems are very much as they were before. Generally, the TTY identification revolves around, you know, where they're located at, direction to them. The assistive listening system signs deal with you know, availability, the assembly areas they're provided at. And, of course, we need to use the international symbols relative to those features for each one. Let's go to slide 23. Now, let's go back and talk about the permanent room designation, the tactile signs. This does apply both to the interior and exterior. And we did do a webinar previously on signage. I would refer you back to that for more detail. I'll briefly go over some things again today in regards to the technical provisions, but we do have a previous presentation archived. The tactile signs, such as for restroom labels, room numbers, and so forth. Again, just to reiterate the point, these are things that are not likely to change at permanent spaces, as we discussed before. Here's a close-up photo of the raised room number with the Braille beneath it. Let's go to slide 24. And I showed this image. This is an image of a office sign with different components of it. We can see that the information on a sign can break out in different ways. For instance, here we have John Smith, director. This would be considered a temporary information and not addressed by the standards. And then below that we see accounting, which is the department. This would be considered informational and meet the visual requirements. And then we see the room number below that, 123. That would need to be tactile raised characters with Braille beneath it. Let's go to slide 25. So in the tactile signs, we have requirements for raised characters, for the Braille, for the finish and contrast. And if we have pictograms, we'll have some requirements for that. I'll address that in a little bit. Let's go to slide 26. Here we have an image of somebody reading, so to speak, the raised characters. And there are a series of requirements for that. The minimum depth of the raised character above its background surface, the text is in uppercase, we use a sans serif character. There are specific requirements for the height and proportion of the character and for the stroke thickness. The stroke thickness is the letter itself, the thickness of the components of the letter. Then we have requirements for character and line spacing. That's the distance between individual letters and between lines of text above one another. Let's go to slide 27. Now, we have, here a couple of figures from the standards that address Braille, its position below type, and also the requirements for the placement of the Braille dots relative to each other. The standards have very specific requirements for the Braille that address, its location, capitalization, lowercase issues, and so forth. So that is addressed in detail, and I would refer you to that. Like a lot of these issues, let's go to slide 28. A lot of these issues get back, the detail and the intent of them go back to the sign designers or fabricators, so I go over them. Some of the other ones that we're more familiar with, perhaps its placement and location, there's some important changes there. The one big change is the height of signs. They're no longer required to be centered on the sign, 60 inches centered on the sign, but are tied to the baseline of the tactile characters. We got a question about this, and I want to note that if this sign only had one line of text, and this is an image from the standard showing the maximum and minimum heights with the area of refuge sign next to the door. If this were done in one line of text, then it could be placed from 48 to 260. This is not establishing different heights for different lines of text, but it's addressing the base of the highest and lowest characters. So if you had three lines of text, that would still be between 48 and 60. So hopefully that clarifies that question. Next slide, 29. Also, the placement relative to the door is also addressed. The sign must be located to the latch side of the door, and there should be a clear floor area provided for the sign of 18 inches by 18 inches minimum. This is so that you can get close enough to the sign to touch it or get close enough up to read it, and if you can view it at a close distance. However, this is not saying that you always have to have an alcove next to your door. If there's not space to the latch side of the door, then you locate on the nearest adjacent wall. And for double doors, the sign should be located on the inactive leaf of the door, or if both leaves of the door are being used, into the right hand, to the right of the right hand leaf of the door, of the doors. slide 30, please. So that was covering the tactile signs. Now let's talk about the informational and directional signs, the visual signs, so to speak. They have a number, and we have a couple examples here, like notice, employee only, sign, kind of a classic in case of fire, use stare, kind of instructional sign, directional sign. And a number of issues are addressed, like conventional form, some of the same character and proportion and spacing issues, character height based on, the character height is based on the viewing distance, how far we are away from it. We have a minimum height location to make sure it's up high enough to be over obstructions. We have, again, stroke thickness is addressed, line space and finishing contrast and so forth. Let's go to slide 31. So when we say conventional form, there's some guidance on that. Here's some examples of scripts that would not be that, such as italic, oblique, cursive, highly decorative, or unusual forms of script cannot be used to meet the requirement. Now, if you say you have a highly decorative, sometimes you see these men's and women's bathrooms and they have kind of a funny sign, it doesn't mean you can't do that. It means you just can't do that to exclusion of some plain text that you can really read, which sometimes all of us would appreciate. Let's go to slide 32. So this is a figure from the standard. It's kind of the men's room pictogram. And now pictograms are addressed in a little bit more detail. The field size is established. This is the background around the pictogram. Of course, we have our finishing contrast requirements, and it does require the text descriptor, which in this case would be men's, to be located below the pictogram. So there are some more detailed requirements in these situations now. Let's go to slide 33. We still have all the same symbols of accessibility. Not much has changed there. They do are still used and they still come up. So they're old friends. They're still with us. Let's go to slide 34. So now the next topic are telephones, which I want to talk about, even though it's sadly they're disappearing. People are easily using more their cell phones and stuff. But yes, they do still exist, and we still need to make them compliant. Here's the chart from the standards talking about the scoping, and this is very similar as it was before. Let's go to slide 35. And we do have some very similar clear floor and ground space requirements. The forward approach is a little more simplified than it was before. In the previous standards, there was an allowance when the foam face was 24 inches from the front of the enclosure, but that's no longer permissible. We just have a simple 20-inch maximum. Let's go to slide 36. The reach ranges to the phone are referenced back. This is an example of where we're referenced back to Chapter 3, the building blocks section. These are operable parts. These parts of the phones are, and it references back to this. And, of course, we'll want to remember one of our big changes, which is the maximum side reach now. The highest it'll ever be is 48. Also, phone book directories and the cord links are also addressed as they were before. Let's go to slide 37. And I just put this in to reiterate that a lot of people who use detection canes use the wall of a corridor as a shoreline to travel along and detect changes in the environment. And telephones have been notorious in the past for causing problems in those situations. This is just to remind everyone not to install them, the phone or its enclosure, such that it's a protruding object. Let's go to slide 38. So this part of the section deals with volume controls. And the big change here is that volume controls are now required on all public phones, all public pay phones. This issue is, instead of being percentage, they're required everywhere. There have been some adjustments to the technical requirements that are a little different, but they're the same basic categories. Let's go to slide 39. There also have been some changes in regard to TTYs. It's now possible that TTYs could happen more often than they used to. In the previous standard, there was an issue with interior and exterior environments. It used to be problematic to have TTYs in the exterior environment. That's no longer the case, and that's been accounted for in the new requirements. You will note that the bank requirement here, the bank of telephone requirement here, is for banks with four or more provided. You have to provide a TTY in that bank unless there is one within 200 feet. And then note that in the second requirement we're showing here for floors and buildings, TTYs are required per floor or per building depending on how the phones are dispersed to the facility. But it's, when we say public building, and I want to be clear that we are talking about a Title II state or local government facility, and when we say a private building, this is really meaning a Title III public accommodation. That's what public and private means in this instance. Again, exterior sites are addressed. They are now required in exterior situations also. Let's go to slide 40. And then there's some specific areas where TTYs have been required. Much of this is the same, although we now have a requirement for rest stops, emergency roadside stops, and service plazas, where at least one public payphone is provided. The requirements for hospital and transportation facilities as much as it was before. Let's go to slide 41. Also, TTYs are addressed in detention and correctional facilities in regard to areas only used by detainees or inmates and security personnel. For those of you working with those facilities, there are some specific requirements. And the shelf for a portable TTY, it's still a requirement when we have a bank of three or more public pay phones. The shelf and outlet requirements are pretty much as they were before, the configuration of the shelf and position of the outlet. There are now some exceptions for detention and correctional facilities and for phone banks with TTYs. Go to slide 42. And the technical requirements for the TTYs themselves are very similar to what they were before. They are permanently fixed and cord length and so forth. Height is now addressed. It is something new. The touch surfaces of keypads are supposed to be 34 inches. Note that it says 24. That's a bit low. It's supposed to be 34 inches. So I apologize for that typo. Minimum above the finished floor. However, there is an exception for this where seats are provided at the TTY. And as I said earlier, the TTY shelf is, for those instances where you're using a portable one, those requirements are very similar to what they were before. Let's go to slide 43. So I'll talk a little bit about detectable warnings. There were some questions around this, and at this present moment, as far as the standards go, as the 2010 standards go, detectable ones are only required at rail platforms. They're required to be 24 inches wide and run the length of the public use area of the platform. Now, detectable warnings can come up in some other situations, depending on the projects you're doing. The Department of Transportation enforces the aspect of the ADA that deals with transportation facilities. These are facilities predominantly used for transportation, like a bus station or a railroad station, that kind of facility. And they do require detectable warnings on the curb ramps. Also, those of you who are getting funding through the Federal Highway Administration project, or have projects funded by the Federal Highway Administration, will need to concern yourselves with the detectable warnings on curb ramps. Let's go to slide 44. So here to the left is an image of somebody using a detectable cane at a transit platform drop-off. We see the detectable warnings mounted along the edge. To our right, we have a curb ramp, and we see detectable warnings mounted on the lower portion of the curb ramp. And you'll note it doesn't go the full length of the curb ramp because those requirements I was referring to earlier from the Department of Transportation and the Federal Highway Administration, they require the detectable warnings to be provided for a minimum of 2 feet from the bottom of 2 foot portion of the bottom of the ramp. Let's go to slide 45. This is also consistent with what's been proposed in the accessibility guidelines for pedestrian facilities in public rights of way. Here are some figures from those proposed requirements, and you'll see they address this 2 foot section and a number of different types of curb ramp configurations. And we do recommend that while these have not been adopted as enforceable yet, we do recommend that in these situations that these are good guidance and something you want to use. So let's go to slide 46. Now, the design of the detectable warnings themselves, there have been some changes. There's now ranges for the dome diameter, for the spacing. This allows a greater range of designs and products to be used. Also, the requirement for resiliency or the cane detection sound has been removed. And a color contrast, while it's required, doesn't have to be an integral part of the material as it once did. So those are a review of some of the technical changes. And let's go to slide 47. Now, let's talk some about assistive listening systems. They're still with us. They're required, I want to note that the requirements are tied to assembly areas. They're required for assembly areas where where audible communication is integral to use of the space. They're not required if no audio amplification is provided. However, courtrooms have to provide them regardless of the amplification issue, so they don't get that exception. What's really important to note is that requirements for assistive listening systems are not triggered or are no longer triggered by the provision of fixed seating or occupant load. Those are no longer a factor to be considered, so it's a change there. Let's go to slide 48. There are systems that are directly hardwired into the assembly area, but these are older and not typically done these days. Most systems now are wireless. So I want to go do a brief review of the systems, and then my colleague David is just going to talk a little bit about the systems themselves. But there's three basic types of wireless systems: infrared, FM radio, and induction loop. Let's go to slide 49. Here on the left, with the left two images, we see a speaker, we see a transmission box emitting FM waves, and we see somebody below it sitting in the audience receiving the FM rays. And then to the right, we have a picture of a transmitter or an emitter up on the wall of the assembly area transmitting the infrared transmissions to people using receivers. Let's go to slide 50. So those are kind of transmitters with receivers. And here we have an image to the left of people sitting in the audience. And we see a yellow line dotted in. And that's because an induction loop system has been permanently installed on the floor. And the people within that area can use it as an assistive listening device. And to the right, we see an example of an assembly area where it's embedded in the wall around the whole space. So that's just to kind of give you a visual representation of the system. And now if David could just talk a little bit about the qualities of the system, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Rex. This is David Bockley speaking. You did a great job of covering a lot of information in a short period of time. I'd like to just say a few fundamental things about assistive listening systems, since I used to work at self-help for hard of hearing people. All three technologies that are used to provide wireless systems are considered good. There's no single technology that's best in all situations. But an infrared system would be the ideal system to select if privacy was essential, like maybe in a clinician's office or a courtroom. An FM system is very useful where portability is needed. You might be able to move it from one room to another, or even when using a battery-operated transmitter, walk around with it for tours. And the third technology, the wide area audio loop, is ideal when you have a lot of people in the audience who you know are hard of hearing and wear hearing aids or cochlear implants that have a little T-switch on them that picks up the signal, because it means they can just come easily into the room and sit down and flick the switch behind their ear to pick up the signal without having to borrow a receiver. Okay, Rex, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay, thanks, David. Let's go to slide 51. Here is the scoping chart from the standards when we have to provide receivers, the number of receivers we provide for the assistive listening system. I believe this I would refer to the chart for details. Let's go to slide 52. I would focus on this presentation, focus on some important exceptions. If you have multiple assembly areas in a building that are under one management, then you can lump all the seats together and determine your number of minimum receivers from that number. Because if you calculate by each assembly area, it may be possible you could have more receivers than if you did it for the whole total. But if you go this route, you have to make sure you get them where they need to be when they're needed. Also note that as we were just discussing that the requirement for 25% of receivers but no fewer than two be hearing aid compatible, this is accepted for the induction loop systems because they are inherently have this feature. Let's go to slide 53. The technical provisions for assistive listening devices are now more detailed. Some of these are more techie requirements that are more of an issue for manufacturers, but it's good to have some awareness of them when you're looking for a system, such as standard jack size, hearing aid compatibility when needed. And then the last three of these are addressing the quality of the sound. So I'll leave that to the technicians. Let's go to slide 54. So talk a little bit about ATMs and FARE machines. I think it's clear what ATMs are, but I would like to add some clarification on FARE machines. These are really transportation related and should not be confused with point of sale machines and OSS devices where we're making a lot electronic transactions, but they're not really FARE machines. For instance, there are these machines you go to the laundromat and you buy like a little credit card in the machine and you put money on it and then you pull it out and you go over to the washing machine and you stick it in and that's how you get the cycle to work. That would not be a FARE card that's covered by these requirements. Now, there would be other issues we'd be concerned about, such as clear floor space, operable parts, and so forth, but they're not covered by this section, so we'll be clear about that. So there's now a number of issues for ATMs and FARE machines that are specifically addressed: speech output, privacy, input controls, some display issues, Braille, and so forth. Let's just do a quick overview of these. Let's go to slide 55. We still have very similar clear floor and ground space requirements. Of course, there are exceptions for drive-up machines, obviously, those you drive up to in a car. We have similar operating. The operable parts have similar requirements. Just again, I would note that we have a different side reach now, and we also have exceptions for drive-up machines too. There's also the issue of differentiating the controls by sound or touch without activation, unless a clear or correct key is provided, but usually these keys are provided. Let's go to slide 56. So I want to talk a little bit about privacy. We have a requirement for providing the same level of privacy for all users. That's good, but I do want to address this issue where some machines have screens, ATM screens, that automatically go blank when they go into speech enable mode, which we're going to talk about that in a minute. And I just want to say this is not good for some people with low vision who still, who take advantage of both the visual cues and the audio. I think having the ability of a screen to go blank is a good security feature, but it should be provided as an option and not as a default situation. Some people have had struggles with that. So let's talk about speech output. There are now more detailed requirements. They address the provision of handsets, which are not used that often these days, or jacks for headsets. And certain types of information, such as security issues, secure information, advertisements, and so forth. There are some exceptions for speech output on these issues. And there are requirements regarding the ability of users to interrupt or repeat the speech and control the sound level so you have some control over the speech. And the speech output is required to address some receipt information, such as balance information, error messages, and so forth. There are also some exceptions there for security. But the speech-enabled output is going to be important for a lot of people. There's now detailed requirements for it. Again, a lot of this stuff is kind of techie stuff for manufacturers, but it's good to have some sense of it. Go to slide 57. Input controls are also addressed in more detail. A lot of these have to do with controls being tactilely discernible, the keypad layout being in conventional layouts in a certain descending order. There are also most of the traditional function keys that are provided have requirements for contrast and the tactile symbols on them. This particular photograph I have here, which I apologize, it actually contrasts a little better in the photograph. It was kind of dark. But yes, it does contract. Let's go to contrast. Let's go to slide 58. There are now requirements that address the display screen. Again, we have some exceptions for drive up, visibility of the screen from the ClearForce space, and there are some requirements for the characters on the screen. And finally, another really important requirement are Braille instructions. So we make that transition from approaching the machine to initiating the speech mode. That's an important connection, so we have to have those Braille instructions. Let's go to slide 59. The standards also now address two-way communication systems, and these are the communication systems that are provided to gain a minutes to a building or facility or to a restricted area within a building or facility. And so the key to understanding these requirements is that they address communications at entrances or entry points and should not be confused with emergency communications for elevators or areas of refuge or these kind of features. This is not what this section is covering. Let's go to slide 60. And we have some basic requirement for two-way communication systems, provide both audio and visual signals, handset cord length, and so forth. Let's go to slide 61. Also, there's some technical provisions to address residential dwelling units. Generally, these are getting at making the communication system at the main entrance accessible and then having the interfaces in the dwelling units being able to be utilized by a connection. Let's go to slide 62. So that kind of is a run-through of Chapter 7. There's quite a bit of material there, a lot of details. There are other places in the standards where we do want to be concerned about communication elements and features. I'll just briefly touch on a few of those. Let's go to slide 63. Of course, transient lodging has requirements for guest rooms with communication features. So we'll want to pay attention to that, particularly those who deal with the lodging industry. And one important change here is that communication features are no longer required in all mobility accessible rooms. You have to have at least one. The overlap between the two types of units is now in the requirements. You have to have at least one that has both features, mobility and communication, but no more than 10% of the rooms can overlap. And this is in response to diversifying these rooms and some of the different user groups that want access to different amenities. Let's go to slide 64. Of course, alarms are addressed. Their alarms and alarm systems are addressed in a very similar manner to the way we talked before. They basically reference back the earlier requirements. And notification devices are addressed. These would be things like incoming telephones, door knocks, and so forth. Some other issues are addressed, like volume controls and having an outlet within 48 inches of the telephone. Now, these features need to be a permanent part of the room. Previously, there were these portable kit devices that were given out, but this approach won't work now. These features need to always be available, and you should note that these portable kits that were being used are always kind of problematic because they had portable alarm issues to begin with. So this is the better way to go, even under the old standards. So you'll note in this picture up here we have the outlet near the telephone for TTY, and if you can, try to have an extra light, an extra outlet in there, so I don't have to pull out the plug for my light fixture. All right. Let's do slide 65. Again, residential facilities are covered. They require a certain number of wheelchair accessible rooms and communication accessible rooms. Let's go to slide. And also I'd like to note that we do recognize that section HUD, there's a HUD coverage issue relative to units that aren't covered. I won't get into the intricacies of that, but I do want to acknowledge that. And these communication units, of course, have to have accessible fire alarms, much in the way we described earlier. And also the smoke detectors need to have alarms on them. Let's go to slide 67. Again, there's some alarm issues that are addressed. And also there are some issues that are addressed at the primary entrance to the dwelling unit. These have to do with notification and identification, basically having a view or peephole or a view opening out the door so you can see wide enough to see what's going on. And let's go to slide 68. There's also a number of communication issues around elevators. I'm not going to go in, I don't have time to go in detail for that, such as this example here is a horseway marker that you can touch from outside, from inside the cab to know what floor you're on. But I would like to talk about emergency communications a little bit. They are covered. They are actually covered by the Elevator Safety Code, ASME or ASME, but the 2010 standard does address these features being within a reach range and the provision of tactile symbols and characters adjacent to it. Let's go to slide 69. And in a kind of a different type of communication feature, we are in the process of addressing classroom acoustics now. This is our rulemaking here. We have been working with the consensus standard, which we were involved with, this voluntary consensus standard for acoustics in classrooms was done with in conjunction with ANSI and the ASA, that's the Acoustical Society of America. And at some point we expect that we'll proceed forward with this, and it will really be an issue of how these technical requirements fit into the scoping of our guidelines and eventually the standards. If you're interested in this topic, I would refer you to the ASA website and to our rulemaking page on this subject, and you can download these voluntary standards. They are available for free download, so you might be interested in that. And with that, I conclude my section of the presentation, and we'll turn it over to David. Oh, and I do want to say one last thing. Somebody had mentioned the mistake, I believe, on slide 42. And yes, that was 34, not 24. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Did I get that right? Let me make sure I got that right real quick. Yes, I did address it. All right, and I'll leave it to you, David.
Thank you, Rex. So this is... Okay, this is David Bakwe speaking. There's a couple things that came to mind as Rex was talking that I wanted to make sure to mention. And he did reference our website. We have a lot of technical assistance available on our website, and that includes bulletins on assistive listening systems that are actually written from three different perspectives, from the installer, the user, and the owner-operator perspective. And we also have an old bulletin on T2Ys.
Hi there. Just your microphone got turned off. If you could turn that back on.
Okay, microphone back on. Thank you. I must have accidentally tapped the computer. Okay, I'm now going to talk about the technological environment. Slide 72, please. The Access Board holds authority under a number of laws to provide information about electronic and information technology. Under the Telecommunications Act, we were tasked with writing guidelines for accessibility of telecommunications products. And then under the Rehabilitation Act, Section 508 addresses information and communication technology more broadly. It's also of interest that the Help America Vote Act referenced the Access Board and allows us to serve on a couple advisory committees that are standing committees to the Election Assistance Commission. Slide 73, please. So here's a picture of a woman at a supposedly accessible voting system. We can see her wearing headphones, the point being she can listen to the choices on the ballot rather than having to read the ballot if she has a visual impairment. Slide 74. So let's talk about Section 508 for a moment. It's a requirement of federal departments and agencies that when they procure, develop, use, or maintain information and communication technology, that it be accessible, and this opposes an undue burden to the agency. And by accessible, we mean conformant with the standards that we wrote, that we issued under Section 508. It's part of the Rehabilitation Act, not part of the ADA. Types of equipment that are covered include web, software, telecommunications products, videos, computers, and a variety of office equipment like copy machines and printers. It's also interesting that it holds requirements for product support documentation. That is, if somebody should ask for, like the owner's manual, that it be available to them in alternative formats if they request it that way, and also that the help desk services be accessible. For example, they may want to get a TTY. Slide 75, please. So now, in contrast, I'm going to talk about Section 255 of the Telecommunications Act, which is a requirement on telecommunications manufacturers and service providers to ensure that the telecommunications equipment that they manufacture and sell is accessible, meaning that it conforms to the Section 255 guidelines that we wrote and that were then adopted by the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, in a report and order which makes them enforceable. Examples of telecom equipment covered include cell phones and landline phones like desk phones. An interesting provision in these guidelines is that telecommunications manufacturers need to consider people with disabilities or organizations that serve people with disabilities in their development, marketing, and testing of their products. Slide 76, please. So here we have an illustration of a steam shovel labeled 255, which is pushing accessible technology up a hill, while at the same time at the top of the hill we have a magnet labeled 508 that's pulling the accessible technology. The point being that this is a push-pull economic dynamic. There's two reasons, two laws, why telecommunications products should be accessible. Slide 77. So why is 508 important? Well, in a nutshell, it helps ensure that people with disabilities won't be left behind in the information age. It supports employment of people with disabilities and improves access to government services. For example, somebody could download their 1040 tax return form from the IRS with confidence that it's accessible. And also, interestingly, because the manufacturers have an incentive to make their products accessible because the federal government demands them to be accessible, they go ahead and make the whole line of products accessible and extend it to the rest of society. So even in your local office supply stores, you might see accessible fax machines and so on. Slide 78. Now, both of these laws are complaint-driven. That is, somebody might ask, well, how can we feel confident that the telecom companies or that the federal agencies will comply with these laws? And the answer is we actually need the end users to raise concerns to the attention of these entities if they believe that the technology wasn't accessible. And so under 255, they can file an informal complaint with the Federal Communications Commission, which is fairly easy to do through their website. And under Section 508, they would direct their complaint to the federal agency that's responsible for the technology. Under 508, Section 504 administrative procedure would be used to remedy the complaint, but a person would also have a right to sue in a private civil action. And the remedy is to fix the problem. So if somebody says, I'm mad and I want to sue for $1 million, what they're entitled to is just injunctive relief, as it's called. Slide 79, please. So the results of compliance, we would expect accessibility in the areas of communication, information, and physical access. So by communication, I'm meaning two-way communication as you would have on telephones. Information might be the text you have on displays, and physical access might refer to the ability to manually operate a telephone or do other things that require mobility. And we just trust that when you follow these guidelines and standards that you end up benefiting people with a wide variety of disabilities. Next slide, please. This is slide 80. It got a little faint. Okay, so here we have an illustration of some telephone accessibility with volume controls and tactile discernible keys. Let's move on to the next slide, please. So it's 81. Okay. Here's a picture of a health information kiosk, and just because I have a picture of it doesn't mean it's accessible. Because I believe this one might be weak in some areas. But examples of things that we'd be looking for are tactile discernible keys. So somebody actually asked a question about the accessibility of screens on information kiosks, and that's one of the main complaints, that if you have a touch screen and you're blind and you're unable to feel the buttons, then how are you going to operate it? And the requirement is that you can keep the touch screen, but that there also needs to be some mechanically operated keys, like a keyboard, for example, in order for it to be accessible. Section 508 and 255 allow for equivalent facilitation, which means essentially the ability to build a better mousetrap. So if somebody, let's say, should take a tablet, which is known to be accessible, and insert that in the information kiosk as the display, then that might be a way of solving the problem without using mechanical keys, because of this solution that's in the software where you can double tap, like on an iPad, to activate functions. But moving on in this slide, this kiosk would also have an audio jack for privacy, similar to an ATM machine, so that, let's say it's saying health information, that everybody in the room won't hear it. And if you've been on for a while and it wants to time you out, let's say it might emit an alert that says, you have 2 minutes, please touch again if you'd like to extend your time. Next slide, please. So here's a slide about biometrics. It's making the point that a wide variety of technologies are using biometrics as a way of authenticating the user. A telephone, a laptop, a mouse, a memory stick, even pay-by-touch point-of-sale machines. And the 508 requirement is that you can keep that way of authenticating, but you need another way in addition to that that doesn't require possession of a particular biological characteristic. And this is something to follow closely, because one day it may be your fingerprint that opens up your car door or your hotel door. We're going to see this technology proliferate. Let's move on to slide 83, please. So if I had to pick out one slide in the whole presentation that I thought was most important, this would be it. Sometimes people with disabilities are given a piece of assistive technology, and the assumption is that they're fine now, that if they're given a screen reader, they should be able to do their job. And the point that's being made in this slide is that being given assistive technology is only one half of the solution. They also need an accessible environment, or what we might call a 508 accessible environment, in which that assistive technology interoperates. So an example would be a screen reader that's being used to help somebody operate accessible software, like their time and attendance for work or their ability to make travel arrangements. The AT and the IT are both important. They complement each other, but they're different. Okay, slide 84, please. So we had a question about accessibility of websites, and I thought I would talk about a few features that make a website accessible. One is the ability to navigate using a keyboard, in other words, not requiring somebody who can't use their hands well or who can't see to use a mouse, providing text equivalents for pictures. For example, if there's a photograph or a chart, that it be described either with captions underneath or with an alt tag, as they call it. That's what you see when you place your mouse cursor over a picture and some words pop up. A screen reader can capture that information and let the user know what the picture was. Captions for videos, of course, for people with hearing loss so they understand the dialogue. And if there's a chart with rows and columns, imagine how lost you could get in that if you're blind. But if there's row and column headers, then they might be able to understand exactly what cell their cursor's in. Slide 85, please. Here's a picture of what we call a CAPTCHA, where we see three letters with kind of squiggly shapes. And the intention is to be able to authenticate a human being as opposed to a robot trying to get into a website and causing spam. And the point in this slide is that this CAPTCHA can be kept as is, but along with it needs to be an audio CAPTCHA where somebody who's blind can hear those three letters, and then both sighted and unsighted users would know what the letters are to enter into a blank to be able to move on and, let's say, create an account. Let's move on to slide 86, please. We often get questions about testing, and I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. There's no seal of approval on accessible products, so sometimes we'll get a question, where can I get listed for my product that's accessible, or where can I obtain such a list because we're looking to buy an accessible product. And so some federal agencies have their own testing centers to help evaluate products, but often procurement officials have to depend on the vendors to provide information about the accessibility of products. When it comes to websites, there are some tools available. You can find these on the Web Accessibility Initiative site, and there'll be a link to that in the following slide. But we recommend that you don't rely exclusively on web evaluation and repair tools, that you still need to have a well-thought-out, robust testing program that's funded and where you've thought through who's going to do the testing, how you're going to do the testing, and what kind of tools you're going to use, that kind of thing. Let's move on to slide 87, please. So as we're moving towards the end of my part, I wanted to let you know that we're actually, the Access Board is in the process of updating our information and communication technology standards, which will cover both the Section 508 standards and the 255 guidelines. We figured we'd do them together because what's needed for telecommunications products under 255 just gets folded into 508, which covers telecom and all the other information technologies I mentioned. And I thought I'd mention some of the things that I thought were new and different that might be of interest to you. One is that we intend to harmonize with what's known as the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. Those were finalized in 2008, and so they're more recent than the 508 standards that were issued 12 years ago. They're going to have provisions for video communication to support sign language so that the technology provides sufficient quality to support sign language communication. There'll be a provision on telephone clarity now that we have voice over internet protocol, or VoIP phones as they're sometimes referred to. it's possible to make the sound more clear and not just louder. So now that we have that technology, we wanted to require it where that technology is being used. And finally, a provision that addresses preservation of accessibility information. So for example, if captions are being sent through a broadcast channel, that the video not strip out the captions, or if you're archiving important documents, that the process of archiving doesn't strip out the accessibility information, or that TTY signals, for example, passed through a digital phone system won't get garbled. Let's move on to slide 88, please. So here are some resources I mentioned. I thought the FCC website might be of interest to you because it provides a clearinghouse of information on telecommunications products. That's new. We have a section, a referral to our Section 508 standards on our own Access Board website. And the buyaccessible.gov website is interesting because it provides information on accessibility of various kinds of products for people that are looking for that information to help them in their market research. Next slide, please. Slide 89. So here's a little Access Board humor with a cat having a mouse dangling from its mouth. But the point is that we get frequently asked questions, and this is one of them, whether a mouse is covered by Section 508. And the answer is yes, that whether it's a mouse or a keyboard or a monitor or an external hard drive, all of these components, even if they're purchased separately, are still covered by the Information and Communication Technology Accessibility Standards. I think that wraps up my part. I'll turn it back to Rex, and maybe we can start to address some questions.
All right. Thanks, David. Appreciate that. So there's a few questions that have come up around assistive listening systems, and we'll talk about those. And one question was, are classrooms assembly areas? And they are. If you look at our definition for assembly areas in the standards, you'll see it mentions classrooms. However, it's important to keep in mind that a lot of classrooms do not have amplification. Therefore, they're not required to have the assistive listening system. However, there are a lot of more larger lecture-style classrooms that do have amplification, and yes, they would have to meet the requirement for listening systems. And this is a good example of where if you had multiple classrooms in a building, where the exception for managing the assistive listening systems could be applied. Also, we had a question about about the fixed seating in classrooms. And yes, the requirement is no longer tied to fixed seating. And they had mentioned if this is an element that was not safe harbored, I will say that it is if you meet, remember, this is an instance, if you meet the previous standard, then you're okay until you alter or add spaces. So yes, it sounds kind of funny to say it, but it is a safe harbor feature until you change it. It's not one of the ones that included as a new feature. It's this change of an existing feature. Okay, and there was a question that asked if when are pictograms required? Well, like a lot of these requirements, they are if you provide something. Really, technically, the only time pictograms are really required is when they're one of the symbols of accessibility, and you're required to denote like the International Symbol for Accessibility for Entrances or the location of a TTY. Those are pictograms, but those are the only times they're actually required. Again, it's based on if provided. And We had a question from, which is a little unclear to me, on a state government building, do we have to provide TTY on each of our floors? It's kind of hard for me to answer that without knowing the particular situation. If telephones are only provided in the lobby, then as far as a fixed TTY at the payphones, it would be only that location. But if telephones are provided per floor, then that would be by each of the floors. And we also had some questions about what is meant by exit discharged, and if exit discharged, how would that differ from exit this way? Really, again, if you say exit this way, that's directional signage. But when you get to the exit, which will really just say exit, that is the actual feature, and that's where that requirement was addressing the exit discharge. It's the actual exit out of the building. If you go up to a stairway a lot of times and you look at the sign that's on the stairway, it says exit stairs. But when you go down and go out of the building, you'll usually see a sign above the door that says exit. We're talking about that sign. And you don't see a lot of times you won't see the sign in a position where somebody can access it tactilely at that location. So let's look at a few other questions here. There were some questions about the placement of the tactile signs beside doors. For instance, one person had said, you know, we have a side light next to our doors. I mean, I have to put the sign over the side light. No, it can be placed to the side of the side light. It's on the next adjacent space. This requirement is not preventing you from putting a side light there. The 18 by 18 millimeter, excuse me, it can be moved to the next available space adjacent to the door. Just remember, it's the latch side that's important. Having it to the latch side. A lot of people, when they navigate through the environment, they're using the hallway, the hallway wall and floor come together. They're using that as a shoreline to navigate through the environment. So having these signs in a particular location is expected. So as people travel along, they'll know relative to the door that where the sign is. But there is flexibility in there. It doesn't have to be absolutely next to the latch side. If there's some other condition, that may be idea, but there's some other condition there that would cause you to move the sign a little bit, that's okay. While we're talking about the location of the sign next to the door, I should point out that there's also an exception on the push side of the door. When you have doors that they have a closer and they do not have an automatic hold device, in other words, the door is not capable of remaining permanently open, it is okay to mount the sign on the door face in those instances. I didn't mention that earlier. I just want to clarify that. That is a possibility in some situations. And let's look here. I think somebody had also asked a question about some more tips for web accessibility. Would you like to address some of that, David?
Thank you, Rex. Yes, this is another question where we can think about resources that are available. On the Access Board website, there's a guide to our standards which takes each provision, let's say about web accessibility, and then describes it in plainer language and gives examples. On the website section 508.gov, there are also courses that you can take. They're in a different format where you click through them slide by slide that might help you understand a little bit about web accessibility. I mentioned the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, WCAG as we call it sometimes, and there's a lot of technical assistance available on that website to address the guidelines that they issued. And there's just a wide number of resources on the internet that can help, including a place called WebAIM, A-I-M. Another question I got was, which laws require videos to be captioned via the internet? And I was reminded of the VCAA, the Video Communications Accessibility Act, that was recently passed and charged the Federal Communications Commission with addressing this issue. So you can learn more about that on the FCC website. And final question was, do state and local governments have a 508 obligation? And although the law, the Rehabilitation Act, Section 508 of that applies only to federal departments and agencies, the states may have their own separate laws that require information technology accessibility. It's less confusing if you don't call it 508, but just call it IT accessibility. California and Texas are examples. You could contact your state technology assistance program. There's an association of technology assistance programs that can help you find the one for your state. And, of course, there's also your Disability and Business Technical Assistance Center, the ADA centers, might be able to steer you in the right direction to find out more about your state laws and also how that might apply to specific cities. Okay, that's all for my part.
Okay, we've had a number of questions about TTY, so I'm going to talk about this for a minute. One question was, am I required to have a TTY in the hotel rooms or required to have communication features? And no, the provision for those rooms is to have an outlet close enough to the telephone that a TTY can be used, but this is the assumption that the person will have a TTY. They'll have brought that with them, and that does not have to be a fixed feature of the room. Also note that there does need to be volume control on the phone provided in the room. And as I said earlier, it's always good to have extra receptacles. I have a personal issue with that, with all the things we plug in and out. We want to make sure somebody has an opportunity to actually have a place to plug their TTY in. Some of these issues around TTY, I think really, because there have been several questions about government buildings and so forth and whatnot, I think some of this really goes back to the effective communication requirements that I had mentioned earlier. So I think some of these questions might be perhaps better directed to the Department of Justice and what they're expecting. Let's go back to the TTY in a hotel room. Now, it is possible that the hotel as a facility may need a TTY to deal with communicating with guests and that kind of thing. So it may be considered an instance that the hotel having a TTY or might be a part of that, but it's not a requirement of the standards per se to have it in any particular location other than the public phones that are provided. So there may be some other policy and procedure issues to deal with this issue, and I would encourage you to follow up with what the regulations address, because effective communications are a part of business transactions and part of program access to state and local government offerings, and it's an issue that really needs to be considered. It's just beyond the scope of the requirements and a lot of questions we have today. Also, we have some questions about the visual alarms, and I got some complaints about the visual alarms in the hotel rooms. Kids coming by and turning them on and ringing them and stuff. Are people in the rooms? I have seen this done, so there is an option to turn the alarm off in the room. You have a switch that turns it off so that people can press all they want, and then they don't wake you up in the middle of the night if you don't need the feature. So that is an issue that can be managed and dealt with. On that note, I will refer it back to Peggy. Enjoy presenting the day, and I'll let her conclude.
Great. Thanks, Rex and David, for a great presentation. Slide 91 here has the Access Board contact information. If you haven't already contacted our hotline for technical assistance, I would encourage you to do so. That number is 800-872-2253, voice, or 800-993-2822, TTY. You can also email us for technical assistance at ta@access-board.gov, or visit our website at www.access-board.gov. So there's been some people who have been asking about previous sessions that have been archived. You can access all of our archived sessions, which there's quite a few at this point. We've been doing these sessions for a little over 2 years now. So all of those can be reached through our website. If you go to webinars, you'll get connected to accessibilityonline.org, which is where you'll find the actual archived sessions. And just a reminder that we have this program on the first Thursday of each month from 2:30 to 4 Eastern Time. Our next scheduled session is Accessible Miniature Golf Courses, and that will be held on June 7th from 2:30 to 4 Eastern Time. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Claudia, and also thank you all for participating.
Okay. Thank you, Peggy, David, and Rex. This is a great session. With this, we conclude the session to exit the webinar. Oh, excuse me, before I do that. Just want to remind everyone that on the website that Peggy mentioned, accessibilityonline.org, we will post the archive. Also, the session is recorded, and we will post the recording with a copy of the PowerPoint presentation on that page. So when you search for archives that were referenced during the session, you can search on there for previous ones. You can also look for today's session. We'll be there Monday. So with that, I will conclude. You can click on the X in the upper right-hand corner to exit the session. Thank you, and have a good afternoon.